Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support, and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to this week's The Male Fertility Podcast. This week we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Yanis Christodoulou, who is an athlete. He's a triathlete for Great Britain and has represented Great Britain in the World and European Championships in 2022. It's an absolute honour to be in the presence of such a fit person, putting us both to shame. But let's not go into that too much. But Yanis, thanks for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, and hopefully it helps others.
There's no question, not in doubt at all. This is what we're all about, is men sharing these stories, these journeys, because the message is that there are so many of us going out there, and this is why, like, it's your voice is such a really important one, because the fact that you are super fit, and it's happened to you as well, and that's. Because it can happen to anyone, and we'll go into that in more detail. So, well, without further ado, I suppose, why don't we start from the beginning, really, is to kind of how things started for you and how you found yourself navigating the fertility or infertility space, so to speak.
So it was basically during COVID. We've been trying for a few years, and we didn't think much of it, to be honest. A bit naive going into it, and my sister had IVF, and it worked for first time. So I'm a bit naive, and didn't really just. I thought maybe because she's just impatient, and didn't really think much of it. My wife just happened to go to GP for nothing related, it was during COVID. And the GP just was having a chat with her generally and said, "Oh, are you looking to have kids?" And said, "Oh, we've been trying for almost a couple of years. And then she put us through the IVF cycle to go through there. And then we had like the doctor with the IVF, I think the in-between, the doctor for the NHS, and she asked us questions about lifestyle and stuff, and that took quite a while. And then they put us in, and she recommended us for IVF funding. And then that's how it all really started, really. And we started the journey that way.
Wow, it's quite interesting that, having had that experience within your close family and then like having tried for a couple of years, that it was almost a chance question, it seems, by the GP. Or had you had any concerns leading up to that point?
No, not at all. I had no concerns at all, really. We both thought, like, because both are active. Mel does, she runs socially with the running club, so just to keep fit. And we just thought we were fit and healthy. It wouldn't really, nothing wrong. So we didn't really think about it too much. We just thought we'd just keep trying. And we had, like, at the time, because I worked for the NHS, I got redeployed, and it was quite stressful. I got moved into I'm an analyst during the day, so I'm office based. I work from home now, and I got redeployed because it was when the first wave of COVID hit. Everyone got moved in for what they were doing, and they had to go and help out in hospitals and stuff. And I got put into a COVID ward. I've got no cooking skills at all, but I was helping in the kitchen, just mainly cleaning. And that really affected me mentally down the line. And obviously that was quite stressful. So didn't really think of it much at that time.
Did you, when the GP first suggested, there could be issues, what was your initial thought on that as a guy?
I thought, just see what happens. I thought, well, I was a bit naive, I suppose. It can't be anything wrong with me. I'm super fit and healthy. I eat healthy. Typical thing, really, a male thing. Yeah, I'm all right. Can't be anything wrong with me. So obviously went through the tests and stuff, and that's how it all just evolved. And then you find out more and more as you get into the more into it, really.
So if you once you've had your analysis, your first analysis. How did that play out in terms of how was that news delivered to you? And what support did you have after that? Because this is through a lot of conversations, obviously me and Sean have had, this is where it's lacking for men. You know, we're told this life-changing news and not much comes after that. So what kind of support did you get and how was that delivered to you?
Yeah, well, no support really. We got, I remember the consultant was basically like said to me, I have to stop cycling. And I said, look, I can't stop cycling. This was, she didn't even know, like this was the first like consultation before we, you know, even done the test, didn't even know who I was or anything. And I said, I can't stop cycling. This was back in 2021. I said, I've got a European Championships, first ever competing in triathlon. And I said, I have to cycle. And she goes, well, there's evidence to say that you can't. And in my head, I was thinking, well, there's cyclists that are having babies and that they're fine. You know, the Kenny is Victoria Kenny. You know, and that they cycle way more than what I do because it's a full time job. And I just was like, well, I can ease off a little bit. Well, I can't stop. And then I did research myself and found out there wasn't like much evidence on it. So that was that. That really annoyed me really, because she's trying to keep fit and then telling me you got to stop, but it was happy for me to swim and run. And that was it really. When we done the tests, I can't really remember too much about it, but I just remember that we both had to change, I don't know, they had to change something. I can't remember, but they said I had a low sperm that would swim. Motility. But they said, if I remember right, they said it wasn't the problem. So I didn't really know much, but they said, I would have to go through IVF. And that was it, really. I had no real support. So again, I was quite naive. I didn't really think too much about it until I was actually in the IVF, you know, process and starting the first cycle really.
Wow. That's you know, it's quite I'm lost for words, I really am, because the fact is that that news was being delivered to you, but not in a clear or understandable way, which is prevalent obvious now, because, you know, when you say, oh, well, unless they're perhaps low motility, but that isn't an issue and you just need to have IVF. It's that kind of knee-jerk reaction almost of, well, maybe if you stop cycling, okay, well, then we'll just do IVF, if you know what I mean. Like, it seems that you weren't really given clear advice there.
No, we weren't. And even when we were waiting, we got the, we were away, we went away and just like at the time went for like a road trip around France. And I remember we got a phone call from the consultant and she said, oh, I'm going to put you through the, get the IVF funding and you'll start soon. And then we didn't hear anything for 6 months later. And then we had the same conversation again, 6 months later, saying, yeah, you haven't got pregnant, have you? No. Okay. Have you changed your diet? I said, well, yeah, sort of. It was already good. So yeah, that was it really. Mel had, I think, something wrong with her end as well. I can't really remember too much about it. Trying to remember, because it was so long ago now. So many things have happened. But yeah, so it wasn't just me. It was like both our sides, but, yeah, we were just like the blind leading the blind, really. That's all I can say. And I mean, in the whole as well, the whole IVF journey as well was pretty much up until the, I'll talk about it a bit later on, but even that was pretty much like we were clueless for a while going through it.
Hmm.
Yeah, it does interest me, the fact of they talked to you about your cycling, but then couldn't really back it up with anything.
You know, no, there was no evidence. I even asked, and they said, like, you just can't have it hot down. And I was like, well, why? Like, if, yeah.
Well, there is some evidence to suggest that cycling can I don't want to use the word like damaging to fertility because it's not like that. It can affect it in extreme circumstances.
Right.
But it's not the be all end all, if that makes sense. Like if cycling is in part of your routine, and obviously as an athlete, it was yours. Like it's really important. So it would be like for me, I'd look at it and say, well, how would we structure that where it's slightly different?
But the thing was, the way I saw it as well, I hadn't been, I started cycling in late 2019. So we had been trying before that because I came from a swim run background. So it didn't really work then. So in my head, I was like, well, if it hasn't worked then, the cycling probably hasn't impacted it at all.
Yeah. There's a lot of things to think about. You have to really kind of analyze it all. And look at it in terms of a training package. How many hours did you cycle a week when you were training?
At that time, I was probably cycling not a lot, about 2.5 hours a week. Like now is like I'm talking about is a lot more. But at that time, that wasn't a lot at all.
No, because the research suggests that it kicks in. Like there's a drop in fertility after around about 5 hours of cycling in a week. But even then, that's not everybody. It's just it just shows there's a little pattern at this point. The reasons for that are it's a bit of a guessing game. It could be that you sat on your balls for a while, it could be that it's heating up, but you know, there's so many things. But they should have that information, be able to share that with you and actually like go, this is what we've got. Maybe think about doing this slightly differently. So it's definitely something they need to look at, isn't it? In terms of when they're delivering this news to guys, having that additional information to back it up.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at someone that went through exactly like I was going through, but say they just cycled, for example, and then for their, you know, their well-being, their mental health, and then they get told to stop, how damaging do you think that would be? And then they find out it doesn't work, you know, and they've wasted the time. You know, it's all like a negative, you know, it can be a negative impact.
Yeah.
I actually know guys that's been the case for, where cycling has been their passion, their hobby, their escape, and they're just told stop it.
Yeah.
Like, and now, and like you said, that strips away more than just the actual physical element of it, of that exercise. It's like you said, it's the mental health, the mental well-being during what is a life-changing situation.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I've definitely had conversations with clients in the past that love their cycling, and for me it's about structuring it so they can still take part, because like you've just said, it's good for that's their mental health thing. They need to keep doing it. It could have an even more detrimental effect if they stop it. stress isn't good for your fertility either. But I just think that clearly shows that, like, obviously if GPs and other professionals are having conversations with guys like yourself and like us, it's important to have just that little bit of extra research to support what you're saying. And it is out there, even if it's small. At least you're like, I think as a man, I want to know why I'm going to do something, right? You want me to stop cycling or reduce it, but why? You know, you just telling me it's not good for my fertility isn't going to do it. I want to see why. But it's, so we've obviously got to the bit of your analysis. What happened after that, after you've kind of had your analysis and probably had another semen analysis, because I like to do it twice.
What
happened after that?
Cool, you're testing me now, trying to remember. I think it improved a little bit, but no difference really. And then we just were put into the, we obviously went through all the tests that we have to have, you know, the blood tests, and like Mel had to do all the tests as well. And then I think we just, and then we got put through to the funding, and then picked the clinic that we wanted to do with, where we wanted to start our IVF cycle. Yeah.
How did you find picking a clinic? Was it a challenging experience, or kind of did you have preference for one just because of maybe location or something like that?
Well, there was only really two around here that, because we didn't realise that with the NHS funding until now. So you're talking about once we finished, that we could take the funding and go to a clinic ourselves. We didn't know that. So we had two clinics. One, I think, was like a 31% pass rate, which success rate, which was, I think, one that my sister went to, and there was another one that was like something like 15%. So it wasn't like really. So we took the one that my sister went with, and we only had a choice of two. And that was probably the same distance away they were. They were good hour and 10 minutes to get to.
Yeah. So you mentioned that kind of in between the first and second sperm analysis you had, that there was a slight improvement. And like you mentioned previously that they asked you about your diet. And like, as we've covered, you know, you were preparing for, at the time, European Championships. So was your diet and nutrition that you needed to follow for your competing, was that at odds at all with what fertility professionals were telling you to do or not do for your fertility health?
No, so the diet was really good, but they wanted me to eat more, you know, veg and fruit, which I did anyway. So it was just increasing that. Really, I don't eat a lot of meat. I've stopped eating. I only have like, I'm not vegan, but I stopped eating. I eat meat, but only like once a week. But they were just making sure that I got enough like protein and stuff like that. But it was all like spot on. I just had to increase the levels a little bit. So there wasn't really much changing to be done for it at that time.
Yeah, that's it. Did you make that decision to eat less meat for training purposes, or was it just
I watched that Game Changers program about, you know, so I watched that. Obviously you take it by a pinch of salt. But we were eating, because being Greek, we had a Mediterranean diet anyway, but we were eating meat quite a lot. And I didn't really enjoy it a lot, you know, most times. Whereas if I eat it now, I really enjoy it. And I was eating, like, I was having salads at lunch with like chicken chunks, but like the chicken chunks that you get from the supermarket. And it started tasting like plastic to me. And like, you know, just I was having, and I just thought, like, I don't want this anymore. Like I want to have something like, you know, like chickpeas or something like that. So just it was just me just changing my diet, really.
That was around that time, was it, that Game Changers came out? Yeah. I remember watching that and going vegan for about a week. They go, just reverted to type. It's hard work. Fair play to anyone who can stick to it, I tell you.
I did it for 6 months. I went vegan, and it was more the fact of we were out having a curry, and I was eating this. This is completely off track, but I'm going to tell you the story. Now I'm eating this curry, and it was like a lambadras or something like that. And Jim just went, "I bet you can't do vegan." And as soon as someone's bet me something, I was like, "Yeah, I can." She goes, "But you can't do it for 6 months." I was like, "Yeah, I can." So that's how I became vegan for 6 months. It was literally because my wife put me in the position I couldn't back down.
Nice.
How did you find it after 6 months?
I found I was fine for around 3 months, and then I started to crave red meat. I just started to crave it because I didn't eat any. I actually then, after 6 months, I introduced red meat again, felt much better. But I stayed off like chicken and that for a while. I just used to eat like steak, lean steak, a couple of times a week. And I actually felt really good on it. I felt really, really good on it. That lighter diet just made me feel better, made me feel clearer in the head as well. Yeah. And it was just about when we were going through our fertility treatment. So it was kind of I think it did play a positive effect on my body. I just stopped eating. And you've talked about it there, like the meat from the supermarket that tastes plastic, that heavily processed stuff. Yeah. It is processed at the end of the day. Yeah. So although I sit here and joke about it, it was probably the first step in starting to really take my diet seriously. Even though I didn't eat an unhealthy diet, you know, when you're facing infertility and you're facing other things, you really start to look at what you're putting in your mouth and what is going to have an effect on you. But even now, like sometimes I'll do 3 or 4 days and won't eat meat, just because I feel it lightens me up a bit. You know, you can get a bit bogged down. It definitely speeds things up. So, but yeah, I think, you know, if anyone's really wondering whether it's the right thing to do, you'll know if you turn vegan or, you know, something like that, within a few days, you'll know whether your body likes it or not. And I definitely was all right for 3 months. And then I just kind of, I lost my vitamin B12 and stuff like that, where you need to get red meat in you to get certain vitamins. Yeah. And yeah, that kind of made my decision. I just craved it. And I just wanted a steak. So what other lifestyle changes did you make, if any? Did you kind of think about your sleep or anything like that? Because obviously as an athlete, sleep's really important. But
yeah, sleep changed quite a bit during lockdown, really. And where I was working, I'd get up at like 7 and I'd leave for work at 7:30 and I get to work for 8 and finish at 4 and then come home, go to the gym and do like either like a swim or something, and get home about like 7 o'clock, 7:30, then have dinner and then stay up to about 10:30, and then go to bed. But or sometimes like doing a swim session with like the masters that I used to swim with on a Wednesday or Thursday night, and that wouldn't start till like 9 o'clock at night. So by the time you get back off, was it 9 o'clock? I think it finished late anyway. By the time you get home, it was really late. Wouldn't get bed to about 11, 10:30, and by the time you go, you know, get up again for 8. So it was really tiring. But when lockdown happened, we started going to bed because I work from home. I don't have all traveling time. So I was able to train earlier. I was able to go to bed earlier. And we kept it going. So like, yeah, we don't go to bed too late. So normally I'm in bed by about 8:30, 9. I do get up at like ridiculous times at like 4:30, 5 o'clock most days, and train, and I feel quite refreshed. But yeah, that's what we did. We had set times, so we would have wouldn't have many late nights, or we kept to the routine for quite a while.
And with that heavy schedule, like with the training schedule, and not to mention actually going away to compete, how did that fit in with your fertility treatment? Was it, because as we all know, anyone who goes for it, those appointments can come at any time. Those injections, for example, that a female partner needs to take have to be very specific times. And yeah, obviously, like, of course they can do it on their own, but we like to play our part, don't we? You know, we're very much part of it. And appointments going together, or tests and results, just it's often a very unpredictable time. So how did you manage that, either whether it's needing that predictability of your training schedule or being away as well?
Well, when I first started the journey, I was probably just getting into triathlon. So I came from a swim run background. So I wasn't training as much as I do now. So I train a lot more now. So during towards the end of it, the last cycles, I was obviously training a lot more. We were quite lucky because it happened. So the first one happened. So we went for the first cycle in October 22, and I was out competing for the European Aquathlon Championships, I had mental health issues going on, anxiety issues before that, and obviously the fertility was going on. So Mel was able to take her medication out with her at a time, because I said we were quite naive at the first one. She was taking her medications with her. So we were going through the cycle there. It affected me in for the race. It was probably, this was a big turning point for me. I turned up to the race in the best possible shape. I mean, I knew I could win it, and I could win it. I was in the best shape ever. I knew I could win it. I knew all my training, everything like that. I knew was completely like I was streets ahead of what I was like a few years back, and I knew that people there would not get near me on the run, for example. However, had the IVF happening, obviously seeing Mel going through the injections, injecting herself every day. I had I had PTSD from, which I didn't know at the time, from being redeployed from the NHS, which hit me later on. And I was starting to have like counselling, but it wasn't really working. So I turned up to this race, and on the day it was an evening race, and I went to the toilet 27 times during the day for number two. And that's how bad my anxiety was. I was a nervous wreck. Turned up to the race, and obviously my race was destroyed before I even started. Got into the swim, had a really good swim, come out in third, and then I got onto the run, and my body just gave up. Just could not run. I don't know what happened. My body's just completely tired, like mentally and drained, and I hated every minute of it. And I said to myself, never again will I do this sport or represent Great Britain or anything. Because I didn't enjoy it. So I ended up getting life coaching, and I've stopped training because it was end of season. So I stopped training for a few weeks and stuff, and I was trying to go longer. I didn't want to train at all. And then I went, had life coaching and started training again, and to try and enjoy it. So I was just doing it, just enjoying it. So that IVF cycle failed. And then the second cycle also failed, but there was different things happened which were better for us the second time. So it was quite tough, but we were quite lucky. And going back, yeah, I suppose I sidetracked a little bit. We were quite lucky with we had most of them in the winter. So we had big breaks. We had the only one I think we had in this was this year, early on in the beginning of the season, when the season had started, and Mo had to inject ourselves, for example, in the first aid tent in one of the races. So it was quite hard, but yeah, we were quite lucky. We had quite a big gaps because Mel, after the first two, we had them. I think we had them quite close together. We decided a bit of a gap, 6 months gap or something, just to let her body recover and stuff, because obviously it's not very nice watching her. But yeah, it was difficult trying to fit it in, and obviously like finding a place for her to inject stuff as well.
Wow.
But obviously you want to try and get on with your life as well, don't you? You don't want to like put it on hold.
That's it. That is it. And that's what so many people struggle with, because it is all consuming. It's always there in some respect, but also you do have a life to live, and it's finding that balance, which is very hard to do. Like was racing, like that one that you mentioned aside, obviously, which you talked about how hard it was racing often an escape for you, or would you often find life's challenges like the IVF creeping into your mind during a race?
I had a few things that happened before. Like obviously the IVF was one. I had my mum had psychosis just before we didn't know what was wrong with her, but she got diagnosed psychosis just before COVID, just before we went to lockdown. So I had that. I also had some negativity in the running club with a few individuals about me becoming a coach, but you know what it's like. It's like a can of Coke. If you shake it, like you can deal with it, and then all of a sudden, if you get more and more builds up, and it just explodes. So, racing was like to escape. But I went through practically 2022, hating every single race. I honestly. I don't remember enjoying any race there. I mean, I stood on the podium for one of them, national championships. I didn't want to be there. I remember every session felt like a chore that I was having to do this. I just hated it. So that race made me think I have to get some help, because it all built up.
Wow. First of all, mate, thanks for being so honest and open. Because
that's all. I just hope it helps others.
It will do, because I think the male nature is to keep things closed in us. You know, we're not very trustworthy of letting our feelings out. But you being open and honest in how you feel is a very powerful thing to hear. So thank you.
No, you're welcome.
With your anxiety, obviously the pressures of racing as well, I can imagine that training sessions, those long training sessions, were really difficult. And how did that life coaching help? How did the structure of that help you kind of clear yourself of that, those negative feelings towards life, but also just like your competition and, you know, what you love to do? Basically, you were in a position where you didn't love to do it anymore because of how you were feeling. So how did like life coaching help you?
Well, before I just remember like going out for runs before I had life coaching and going out for runs, and I just have so many negative thoughts going in my head. I just could not even think straight half the time. I felt like an Incredible Hulk sometimes. It just wasn't me. I've always been a positive person. I've been closed to people, but I'm quite a happy person and stuff, and it just wasn't me. So life coaching happened to be Mel does. She helps out with this elderly tea party for elderly people that are on their own. She does it once a month, and they get together in people's houses. And one of the hosts there was talking to about life coaching. So I also had acupuncture as well. So I started having acupuncture first, and he actually, for the fertility, to start off with, for the second time, because Mel had it, for the second time, second cycle. So Mel got me in touch with this guy, and I had a chat with him, and I said to him, look, the anxiety issues and stuff like that. So he said, oh yeah, I've had this before, and I had acupuncture. At the same time, I went and had life coaching. So I had these two little puzzles, I suppose, bits coming into the puzzle. Life coaching, basically, I had CBT, and it didn't work. It just afterwards it just came back. So I had that prior, and I had counselling, and I thought counselling was just a waste of time for me, because it sort of blocked it, and then I felt fine, and all of a sudden I'd be worse, like, if you know what I mean. Where, and CBT was helping a little bit, but after a while it just came back. But with life coaching, I still work with her now. She was she was amazing, really. So she gave me the answer. You know, I had to bring out the answers. So when I went to her, I was actually a nervous wreck, and she said I was a completely different person, like, now compared to the day one. And I just said to her, look, I don't really want to give up my sport. I know, like, my well-being. And I said, like, I know the pressure with, like, trying to get medals and stuff like that, and the pressure I was put on by training and stuff. And I said, I just want to learn. I'm a coach and decided to take my own training in my own hands, do my own training. And I said, but I want to enjoy it more, and to enjoy it. And just like remapped the way that I was thinking about it, like, to enjoy it. All goals were to enjoy it. So instead of like going, like, for example, I would put, if you asked me before that, I'd put like, I'd turn up to a race and say, well, I want to come in the top three. I want to come in the top three. I want to come top three. I would say that all the time. I wouldn't say anything else. Now going to a race, I'd be like, okay, I want to enjoy it. I've not raced here before. I want to enjoy it. Take it all in, because when I first started, it was all about enjoying myself, and just take it all in. And then if the results come, see how it goes, and that's it. And I turned up to a so I did this middle distance triathlon, the national championships. After that, I had a crazy goal to do all the British championships in different distances in a multi-sport, and also three national championships. So there was nine in total. And I had a crazy idea, goal of doing all them, and seeing what happens. Turned up to this national middle distance championships. And at the time, we were going through a second cycle, and I actually eased off with the cycling while we were going through it. And I thought, after we've had the implant and stuff like that, see what happens. So I increased the cycling a bit, and I just end up turning to this race the most relaxed I've ever been. Like, normally I'd be a nervous wreck before a race. Turn up to this race, had no expectations. Never done a middle distance triathlon before, so I never expected to do well. I just went in there just to enjoy it, and end up winning it. and surprising myself, not knowing them. So, but I was enjoying every single minute of it, coming out of the swim. And I realized that when you're happy and you're enjoying it, your body's different, and your mental state's different. And all of a sudden, I was hitting like levels that I didn't think I was capable of doing. But obviously, on paper, I knew, like, if you told me a few years ago, I'd say, oh, yeah, it could be possible. But just, yeah, being a lot happier and stuff. And you can see me in photos, like even races, I've got thumbs up, I'm smiling. People talking to me, like the crowd, like people like watching and like talking to them, stuff like that. And that's how relaxed I was. I mean, I can tell you an example. So an even better example. So I did the World Championships in Hamburg in last year. I did the middle distance British Championships 5 days before. Now, I'd never have done the sprint championships and the race straight afterwards. I did it. I wasn't intending to take up my position, but I took it. Now, I got ill for the middle distance championship, so it wasn't a great race, but I still enjoyed it. I turned up to this race, this world championship, and no expectations at all, just to enjoy the experience. I was still sore from the race from 5 days earlier because it was big race. And people like, I was talking to people, like I talked to people, like, whereas before I wasn't, I just like had my hoodie over me and just walk into transition, put my bike up, you know, stuff like that. I would not talk to anyone, but I was talking to people, they would laugh and joke. And even on the day of the race, a few hours before, I was dancing in the hotel room, talking, listening to music. And Mel said to me, this is the most relaxed you've ever been in a race. Like, I haven't got a clue about bike. My bike went wrong. There was something wrong with my bike the day before. I had to lug it on the bike box quite far away to get to the team hotel to fix it. Normally, I'd be scared about wasting energy and stuff like that. And it was the most relaxed. So that's what life coaching did to me. It teached me to enjoy it more and be more relaxed. And I think this is why maybe the fourth... we had four cycles IBF. Maybe that's why the fourth cycle worked. Relaxed.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Is, do you think that coaching, even though you went there for the your competing side of things, do you think it had a knock-on impact to your fertility treatment because of the mental state, that the better mental state it was putting you in? So I think you just answered that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think obviously the acupuncture definitely did as well. That helped a lot, but yeah, it definitely helped with the impact with it. And but then talking about the fourth attempt, I gave up on the fourth attempt. Like I just said, because we had four attempts, we were quite fortunate. We had four attempts with our NHS trust. So I said to we had come to an agreement that we would try one cycle private if this didn't work. I didn't really have anything. I wasn't really happy with the clinic. We complained, and I know people that went into the clinic who were doing privately and got better service. I complained to the doctor on the final thing. I told her, and we sent letters and we complained about it and said, look, their communication was rubbish. They were sending us all sorts of things, wrong appointments and stuff like that. Like our third cycle, they told us to be there at 10 o'clock. They phoned us up. We were just pulling up. You know, when you turn up for a cycle and they say you've got half hour, they told us to be at 10 o'clock. At 5:02, we're just pulling up outside saying you're late. And we're like, what? You told us 10 o'clock. No, 10 o'clock's the thing. No, that's not what you told us. So we got in there. They took us straight into the cycle, straight into the room. And then within 5-10 minutes, Mel was like having the implant. Like how much is a rush of that? So I complained about that and stuff. So yeah, the fourth attempt, we just basically, I said, look, we'll try go private once if it doesn't work, and then we'll have to look at other avenues like adoption and something like that. I sort of given up. So I was more, I think I felt more relaxed with it. Like when I say given up, I don't mean like I've given up. I just wasn't, I just thought, well, just do it and then see what happens. Like I wasn't like holding my breath. And Mel was sort of like, the same sort of thing. She said, I'll go for it. We'll give it our best. But, you know, like after the first three fair attempts, because all they told us when we failed three times, you're just unlucky. I mean, come on, unlucky. I had to go to this, I spoke to this doctor, complained about it, and I remember having a conversation with her. They wanted to do this thing, test for male for steroids. I think it was like 1,800 quid, like to see, to kill anything in the womb or something, just to check if she needs it. And I said to them, why would I pay 1,800 quid after I think your clinic's been so bad to us and all this communication stuff, when I can put that £1,800 into like a private clinic, I could save the money. And whatever happened, she decided to put us on it in the end. So they did different things. We did different things as well, like Mel went and saw a nutritionist. But I think, but being more relaxed definitely had a big impact on the final cycle for sure.
Mm. And what you mentioned that final cycle, like, do you want to share what the outcome of that one was?
Yeah, so I'll tell you. So the first, Mel does the 2 week test, and she's crying in the bathroom. And I said to her, why are you crying? Like we'll do one more cycle. We'll go private. We've saved up, so we can do it. And she went, no, look, and it said, yes, you're pregnant. So that was pretty special. Then we went out to the European Championships a few days later. So we obviously phoned the clinic, told the clinic. We didn't think it worked. But when I normally, Mel would help me with my bags and stuff, but because she was like, it came out pregnant, I said to her, look, you can't hold anything, you can't do anything, stuff like that. So I dealt with it. But what I felt, at the end of the race, I came third in a race at European Championships, the best race ever. But Mel was struggling to walk, and she was struggling to walk. We had a hotel up the hill, struggling to walk up the hill. We're just walking normally, and she's quite fit. And I was in my head, oh, yeah, she's definitely pregnant. So, and I was like, it's got to be two. So, we went up to the clinic, and they said there was one, you've got one heartbeat, baby heartbeat, and Mel started crying, and I was smiling, but I was like, there's definitely two. And then she turned around and said, and there's the other one. And we were like crying, and like, I just said, I knew it. And so at the moment, we're expecting twins quite shortly.
That's incredible. Congratulations to you both.
Thank you very much.
When you've been on this real journey, it's an amazing bit of news to get, isn't it? Like, especially as it goes along each, you know, every time you have another scan, every time you have another appointment, it becomes more real.
Because it does come.
You do sit there with this little bit of fear, don't you?
The thing is, it hasn't been easy playing sailing. I mean, I don't know what happened with Sean when he had his, but we had a 12 week scan. I mean, the appointments were a mess. We got our first scan, first appointment was 16 weeks, and I was like, well, that's not right. So we had to go back, and they booked in this 12 weeks. That was fine. And then we went for 2 weeks later, and we were sitting there, and the guy was scanning up, and I said to him, he looked a bit like confused, and I said to him, oh, if you're right, and he just ignored me. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe he's just too busy. And then at the end, he goes to us, one of the twins is 28% smaller, we need to refer you to the FMU unit. And I was like, okay, what does that mean? So I can't inform you. So, and then that's when really we started fearing the worst. We had scans pretty much every week ever since. We were told we were likely to lose one, most likely. Even our twin consultant, I think three times, told us prepare for the worst. It's only now up until a few weeks back that they said that they were over the magical 550 grams, the smaller one, and they can get them out if they needed to. we're now 30 weeks in, and they said the smaller one is now almost 40% smaller, but still growing, just a big one's growing even more and probably eating more. But so now they get their weight, they're deciding whether they need to get them out. They're trying to hold out for 34 weeks. But it's never ending. It's just, it's been quite stressful. Like, for example, I went to a race in Cyprus, a 4-day event. I got invited to just race that. And because my family are from Cyprus, I thought I'd do it. And Mel couldn't travel. And she went in for a routine scan 3 weeks ago, and then just for a normal scan. And then she ended up being in the hospital for 12 hours. I came back and I was rushing to the hospital just to say that they said that one of the smaller one, the blood was restricted a little bit, but they were doing the scans for the heartbeats, that because they were under 28 weeks, then they couldn't get the heartbeats, they couldn't get them. So they tried it 3 times. Obviously this equipment takes like an hour and a half, so 3 times, and they wanted to keep her in. But then we went back 2 days later, and they said everything was fine, but they still wanted a scan, and then that didn't work again. It gets a bit nerve wracking. But now it feels a lot better, because now we know they can get them out now if they need to. But you probably went through all that, Sean, I'm guessing.
Similar, yeah. It was very, very anxious time. The whole pregnancy, and because it took so long to get there,
you
put so much into it, emotionally, physically, mentally, and then when we got there, it was just a nerve wracking time. I remember it well, and bless you, we didn't quite have it with what you had, with that sonographer kind of saying he needs to refer you to a unit and not telling you why. That must have been really, really, gut wrenching. So fair play, we're close now, so we'll be thinking of you for the next few weeks, certainly.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is just amazing news. Every time I hear that someone's had a success story and things are going well, which brings a smile to my face, because we've both been there. We know what it feels like. You have reached your pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's what we all want. Have you, in terms of obviously talking about your fertility issues, have you spoken about it to your fellow athletes and in the sport itself? What's the awareness generally in your sport about fertility?
I don't, to be honest, don't really talk about it to them much. Because triathlon's it's quite an individual sport. So when you are competing with people, you are like other GB athletes, you are competing against them. So, but what I did when the second time failed, we kept it quite close. We only told family, and that was it. Like my sister, Mel's family, mum and dad, and my mum and dad. That was it, really. We kept it quite close. And people would say to you, are you having kids? Or why aren't you not in the running club? We haven't seen Mel for 3 months, for example, when she's going through the injections. And I just thought, I just said to Mel, we need to just open up on it. I think it's best to open up and see what happens, just see how it might help other people. And so I opened it. First, we put it on Facebook, and then which is closed just for friends and stuff. Then I put it on social media, on my media outlets, and I was just absolutely blown away by the support and honestly how many people were going through it and suffering without telling people. I was getting hundreds of messages in my inbox and saying, well done for opening up. I had relatives that I did not know that were going through it. I had friends that were going through it. I did not know. I had someone tell me that they haven't told their parents. They didn't know what to do. They're on their third attempt and it's not working. And it was just, I just was helping people there to help, bring it out to help people. And loads of people just opened up and, it was unbelievable, the support. I mean, and unbelievable people like sending me messages about it. I was shocked. I didn't know much about it. And then I came onto the, I wanted to help out the, cause I realized after realizing how common it was and how like people didn't talk about it, and there's not a lot of support for people about it. I came onto the Fertility Network UK to ask if I could be an ambassador for them to help them and like give something back. And and also I was on ITN News in the summer about it. And I had people send me messages. A close friend sent me a message, was quite nice, saying that people will see that and think, well, actually, yeah, they're going to be okay. And I just hope it helps people. I found out I found it helping getting it out there and spreading the word, I suppose, and telling people like it. Yeah, you'd be surprised, and the support. But then, of course, there's that other thing that people brush it off, and you know, there was the things where we were going, people were brushing it off, and we were feeling quite bad from it.
First and foremost, well done for putting yourself out there and sharing, and that reaction that you got shows just how much people appreciate it, because it is such a, you mentioned the lack of support, that the silence is deafening at times, but what you mentioned is so crucial for anyone else listening, is that when you open up and those, like, you know, there are people, like you said, that close friends and family who are going through it, people in your inner circle could be going through the same pain and so desperately needing to speak and wanting someone to talk to who just gets it, and they could be closer than you think. So I think that's really a really poignant thing to bring up there, because it is happening. The statistics say that 1 in 6 people worldwide will go through this, and you've essentially proved that with those people that are close to you who reached out to you immediately.
Yeah, it was very surprising how many people. As I said, I was quite naive about it when I first started. I personally thought you get a few injections, you know, and then it's not talked about, and you'll get pregnant, you know. I had no clue. Even like you meet like 10 people, like for example, we were in a coffee shop with people, and like they were talking to us, we were saying it failed and stuff, and then they just brush it off and say, oh yeah, we're due. Like, and that's not what you want to hear. I don't know whether it's because people are not aware of it, but then you get other people that turn around and say, I don't actually know the process, can you tell me about it and stuff like that? But I think it's not people aren't aware of it.
No, well, that's the thing, is if people haven't experienced it, it's really hard to understand. And typically you do get two responses from that. One is that kind of thing of, like you said, brushing it off, filling the silence because they feel awkward often, rather than you know it's you're sharing this and letting them in to this very important information. And yeah, if they don't know what to do with that, they can often say the wrong thing completely out of their own uncomfort, or the right thing to do is just say, wow, that must be really hard. I'm sorry that you're experiencing that. I don't know what it is, but can you tell me about it? Wow, that is like, that's next level stuff, that.
Yeah. And that's probably why people don't want to speak out about it, because people's reaction sometimes, they don't know how they're going to react.
It's a leap of faith. It really is.
Yeah.
Because you're putting yourself into a vulnerable space by speaking out, and you really, if it's not received well, because often people, it's not a case of just like not saying anything and then suddenly saying everything. Often people put out small hints and stuff, and they can often, if they're not treated appropriately and received very well by people, that puts that seed in of, oh, if I put myself out there further, what's the point? People aren't going to get it. They're just, I'm going to end up getting hurt. And so, yeah, it's a tough one because it's such personal information. Of course, we don't have to share everything we're going through, but what Kieran and I have now been doing for 3 series is saying that actually, if you can and do it in the right way, in the right environment, to the right people, sharing will really help you. Because like you mentioned the Coke can analogy earlier, it will help prevent you explode by sharing these big traumatic events.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like when you start having those conversations, just who else is going through it? You know, there's 3 guys talking in this conversation and all of us have experienced that. You know, you say it to someone and they turn around and go, oh, yeah, so-and-so's going through that. And you both know this person and suddenly, like, you realise that literally 5 people within your everyday life are going through this without...
Well, I had that in my work. I don't know if I mentioned it before on the pod. I don't know, Kieran, right back into series 1 maybe, but... Once I started opening up to my work colleagues, which was almost 2 years down the line of us going through it, I worked in an office and I sat next to a girl, and on the other side of her sat another lad. Like, and we were like quite pally, me and this guy. You know, we lived in a similar area, so we'd often travel in together and went for a lot of beers together and stuff. But so I opened up to her first, and she said, "Yeah, Martin, who is that guy? One seat away from me, past her," said, "Yeah, Martin and his wife went through this." She said, "Seriously, what do you guys talk about?" And I was like, "Well, not that." I think my response was something along the lines of, like, football, beer, boobs, you know, all the usual lad stuff. But that's the thing, is we just don't. And then I spoke to him, and he was so forthcoming with help and information and, like, clinics and just what to do and helping me understand it a lot more. And it's mad. Like, that was there for 2 years. And if I just harnessed it earlier and found that inner strength to open up earlier, because once I did it, everything got easier, especially in a work context, because, you know, yeah, I was hiding appointments and all that. And yeah, he was an absolute, like, font of knowledge for me. And you know, he was not backwards and coming forwards about it, but again, it wasn't pub chat. It wasn't something that, even though he didn't mind talking about it, he just didn't bring it up unsolicited in the pub, if you know what I mean. It's just because it is ultimately it is private information, and I guess you just think, oh, if no one else is going through it, then they don't need me to share it. But people, you never know.
It's also getting into that conversation. How do you, like, start it? Yeah. That's the thing as well.
That's it. You'd be like, oh, so yeah, did you see the football last night? Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was good. Right. I haven't got any sperm. So, but it's a bit of a hell of a segue.
I'll tell you, I think the most random thing that's happened, and we were both there, Sean. Do you remember in the summer? I went down to visit Sean in the summer, and we went to a cold plunge bath and sauna place. And we were in the sauna. Don't use a sauna if you're trying to improve your fertility, by the way. But we were in there. We were relaxing. And there was that woman in there that you were suddenly having the world's biggest conversation about donor sperm with them, because she was looking at, inquiring about donor sperm. And it was like, this is random. We were just having a cold plunge in a sauna. And then suddenly it's all about donor sperm.
Did you see, there was another bloke in the corner and he was like shrinking into the corner. I go, oh my God, I'm well out of my depth here. But yeah, literally, she just mentioned it to another girl in there and I went, oh yeah, we use donor sperm, me and my wife. And she's like, what? And then, yeah, I was just, because, like, I think it's just a shock for a bloke to be so open about it. I told her all, like, you know, what Kieran and I do. And yeah, it was, we ended up talking for so long, we had to get out before we fainted.
It was so hot in that sauna. And I got up in the end. I was just like, I can't stay in here. I'm just going.
Yeah.
But yeah, anywhere. It can, any conversation, anywhere, it can just come up. And it's amazing. And people are always so, like, we were, like, just overheard a conversation. But if you've got a bit of knowledge and you hear something, if it's the right time, don't be afraid to, create that conversation. Yeah. I think it's really
so important. I said something to her, didn't I? I can't remember what it was now. She's like, oh my God, thank you. I'd never even considered that. I was not preaching. I'm not lecturing. I just talked her through some of the considerations when you're exploring alternate routes to parenthood. Specifically donor conception. And she was like, oh, I'd never even considered that. Thank you so much. Yeah, I can't remember what it was. But yeah, you know, it's like Kira said, when you've got that little bit of extra information about a subject, just to share it and help someone else, like, go along the way a little bit easier. So, yeah, it's a powerful thing.
What did you learn about yourself during this journey, mate?
Cool. Quite a lot. First I thought, yeah, I was quite closed, more open now. Learned more about myself in a way of like to look after yourself better and know the signs of like if something's not right, you know, like mental health issues and anxiety. Knowing that life's not easy. Just take each day as it comes. That's what I learned.
Nice.
Yeah, man. It's true. I think a lot of people learn things like that. It is a horrendous experience. You know, you can kind of describe it as that. Yeah. But being able to be at peace with it as much as you can and take each day as it comes is definitely a
skill. I mean, you could say, I suppose, the men get it easier. I mean, but it's not nice watching your partner or your wife like injecting herself, going through, you know, the hormonal changes. You know, the brain fog. You know, like things like that. Like you could be out. You know, it's really tough. For example, you can go. I'll use an example. We were planning for my 40th birthday last year, and we were talking about getting a Greek singer. If we couldn't get hold of the singer that we wanted, we had another one, and we were chatting, and then about 4 days later, she's going through the medication and stuff, but 4 days later she goes, oh, where have I known this guy? And obviously we've had a conversation about it, do you know what I mean? And it's really hard, like when you think like and you realize like how hard it's for them as well, like you see things like that, but people don't see that, do they? People don't realize what you go for. And I also think as well with like maybe work or people don't think the man, you know, the man doesn't go through it as bad, but obviously you see everything going on, and obviously you still got to be there and stuff like that. And I think, yeah, it does take a toll on you.
It does. And there's a lot of guilt, isn't there? Like,
yeah.
Because you think, oh, you know, you're seeing them go through it, and you just, if we could take that pain, and especially like the bruising and the tenderness of the injections, you'd take it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard for, no matter what situation you're in. So, yeah, it's, you know, we always say, like, we salute anyone who puts themselves in there and repeatedly as well, because you know, like you went through multiple rounds and you kept finding that strength and courage to go again. You had each other, and it's quite obvious that you were a great support for each other as well, especially Mel going out to like with you when you're competing and taking her injections out and doing it in the medical tents and stuff. So it's a lovely story, it really is. And we're very, very grateful for you sharing that for us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, man. We really do appreciate it. And we've said it before, and I'll say it again, like so many guys are going to get something out of this conversation. It's been incredible. Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of every interview podcast that we do, we always ask the same question as our final question. And that question is, if you could give one bit of advice to a man facing infertility, what would that bit of advice be?
I'd say no matter how hard it gets, keep moving forward. Keep pushing yourself to get there and stay positive. Just stay positive. By being positive, a lot of great things can happen. It's not an easy journey. It's going to be a very hard journey, and it will make you, I think, a better person as well. But just stay strong, and I'll just take each day as it comes, and just go along the ride, but keep moving forward.
That's great. Amazing advice. Yeah, thank you.
Great advice, mate.
Yannis, if people want to follow you, obviously, as you mentioned, you are sharing the story now. You're on ITN, and you mentioned it on your Instagram a few times, and also you share what you're doing with your competing. So if people want to keep up to speed with that, hey, that's a great pun there. where can they find you on Instagram?
They can find me on Instagram, and it's my first name Yannis dot, and then it's my surname Christodoulou. I can spell
I'll put it
out.
In the show
note. Okay, yeah. So it's Yannis dot Christodoulou. You can follow me if you want. I post a lot about fertility. I used to just post up just sporting stuff, but I've been more open ever since COVID. I was more open, like even just posting about walks and what I was doing. So I post up a lot about what's happening with the twins and about the fertility journey itself and my mental health issues. So if you want to follow me, feel free to.
I'm so glad that you are sharing every aspect of that. The world needs more men like you, so thank you. Thanks for sharing it with us, and thanks for coming on today.
Thank you guys, and thanks for having me on there.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at The Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.